Welcome to Behind the Page, the Eli Marks podcast, with your hosts, John Gaspard, and me, Jim Cunningham.
Of all the podcasts on all the networks in all the world, Jim Cunningham walks into mine. How are you, sir?
I am well. And you, everything okay? That's a Casablanca reference if you're scoring from home.
Yes, it leads up to one of the most misquoted lines in movie history.
But it's not play it again, Sam. It's play it.
How's that you're playing?
Oh, just a little something on my own.
Oh, stop it. You know what I want to hear.
No, I don't.
You played it for her, you play it for me.
Well, I don't think I can remember.
If she can stand it, I can. Play it.
Play it. Play it. Yeah, it's a great scene.
It is a great scene.
By the way, this is season 4, episode 13 of...
Sorry.
Of the Casablanca podcast. Anyway, today we have just as much of a freewheeling conversation as we just had with a guy named Jonathan Sadowski, very popular in a TV show called Young and Hungry, which I was not aware of, but I think that show ran for 5 years. He was in the show Bleep My Dad Says with William Shatner, the one and only. He's in Live Free and Die Hard with Bruce Willis.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not kidding. But in addition to that, being an actor in LA and also a producer in LA, he's a magician. And he came up with a trick called Predicto. And I saw him demonstrate it online somewhere. And I needed something for a bunch of fourth graders. And it was perfect for fourth graders. I'll have a link to how Predicto, what it looks like in the show notes. You can see Jonathan demonstrating it. But it was just the perfect superhero card trick for fourth graders. They just loved it. And it's really clever and really fun. And he's a lot of fun to talk to.
Yeah.
So, as with most of our interviews, you know, I came to magic relatively late in my life. Jim, you've been doing it since you were a teen. But I'm always sort of interested to find out when real magicians got into magic, what was it that got them into it? And that was the very first thing that I put to Jonathan. First question is, what's your magic origin story? When did it all start?
It was a warm day in Chicago, and the year was 1988. I was probably like 9 or 10 years old, and I'm from the south side of Chicago, and I remember there was a magic show at one of the churches in like their big banquet hall, or the gymnasium, and I'd never been to a magic show before. You know, there's not a lot of big shows in the south side of Chicago. And I go to this show, and I won the door prize. I won the raffle, and it was a magic kit. And I remember watching this show and just being blown away. That was the first time I saw things like, you know, the zigzag lady, and I saw, you know, the metamorphosis, and, you know, the subtrunk, and I saw all this like zombie ball for the first time. And I was like, it was just like this sensory overload. And I got back home, and I was, you know, couldn't wait to dig into my magic kit. And there was a church across the street from my house as well. Churches everywhere in the south side of Chicago, like every corner. And my mom was in the choir, and she came home one day and she said, you'll never guess who the new organist is. And I said, who? And she said, the great Franchini. And that was the guy who did the magic show. And I freaked out, and she was like, he wants to meet you. And I went to meet him one day, and we're to this day, we're best friends. And he taught me music and magic and just what it's like to be an artist and performing on stage. And that's how I got into it. And ever since then, I kind of got the bug. You know, every time I'd go to the school library, I'd check out a book on magic, or, you know, every once in a while, when my dad had time, he'd take me to Izzy Rizzy's magic shop on the South Side. And yeah. And then, you know, as I got older, I did lose touch with magic a little bit. And, I was always the guy in college who would kind of do tricks for people. And I got a few numbers that way as well. I remember back in LA, I was like, you know what? I missed this. And then I was driving down Ventura Boulevard one day, and I saw this sign that said the Magic Apple. And I was like, there's no way that's a magic shop. And sure enough, it was the magic shop. And I went in there and I met Brent and dove right back in, man. And, you know, 22 years later, it's more a part of my life than ever.
That's fantastic. I should just say, as an aside, when I reached out to Brent to reach out to you, his response was, well, I'll happily send the email along, but wouldn't you rather interview me? And I say, we'll get to you, Brent. We will get to you. We just did a magic shop owner recently, so we gotta wait a little bit. But I thought it was that's a good salesperson right there.
I love it.
Yeah, the Chicago, great magic town. A lot of great magicians in Chicago. Did you get a chance to have any other the great Franchini
The great
only?
Franchini, that was my mentor growing up. Then I went, I would frequent Magic Inc. I'd go to Ash's Magic Shop on the North Side. Yeah, so it's a great magic town, man. It's a
It
great
really
magic.
is. It's a tremendous magic town. Especially Magic Inc. Was Jay Marshall still there at that point? Did you get a chance to?
Yeah, I mean, I was young. I was young when I went there. But for the most, I actually went to Mr. Ash's a lot more. I don't know if you guys knew Mr. Ash. He passed away recently. But he was like this old school magician. Every time me and Frankini walk in there, he always go, "Frank, do you want to buy a magic shop? You want to buy a magic shop?"
So other than the great Franchini, did you have other mentors? Chicago was just, I mean, you couldn't swing a dead cat without hitting a great magician in
No,
Chicago.
to be honest, I've lived in Los Angeles longer than I've lived in Chicago now.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, I went to college when I was 17, and then, once I graduated from college, I was 22 years old, and I moved right to LA. So I was, I my the majority of my magic upbringing has actually been in Los Angeles.
Huh.
So about what age did you stop doing it in Chicago? And then how old were you when you picked it up again in Los
I
Angeles?
mean, I did magic for like little parties and stuff like that all through high school. And then in college, like I said, I kind of stopped. But then when I got back into the theater, I started performing a little bit again. But I mean, I literally bounced once I got my degree. I was like one way ticket to Los Angeles. So I would say like when I was like 23, 24, I started getting back into it. And then but even in college, like I remember they had Dallas's magic show. Was it Andy Dallas? Was he? He was like he performed. So I went to college at the University of Illinois down in Champaign-Urbana, and
Okay.
they had Dallas's magic shop there. That was the big one. And I think his name was Andy Dallas. I think he passed away now too, but he was like a regular on the Bozo show, and all. He was like a big Chicago guy as well. So I would always go in there and pick up little trinkets and stuff, and little packet tricks. But then in L.A., I remember like Franchini and my other buddy John Tresniak, and they took me to the Magic Castle for the first time when I was like 22, 23. And that's when I really started meeting all these other like local magicians from Los Angeles. And then I became a member of the Academy of Magical Arts when I was, whoa, maybe my early 30s.
Do you remember your
And
audition process?
I do remember my audition process. I was super nervous, which is crazy because I'm an actor and I auditioned like for a living, I guess. But yeah, I walked in there. I did some card stuff. I think I did like a mentalism effect, and then I remember John George grilled me. Man, did he grill me about books I've read. And I remember I'll never. I was like, yeah, Stars of Magic. He's like, name three tricks from Stars of Magic. And I was like, whoa, yeah. And I was like, yeah. But
Were
they.
you able to do it?
Yeah, I did. And I got in, and then I met, I think there were like 12 of us that auditioned. I think four or five of us got in. And one of my closest friends to this day in the magic world, his name's Joe Thomas. He lives in Louisville now. I remember I was the first person to audition. And I came out of my audition and I saw him just like messing around with the other magicians waiting to go in. And he did two effects, and he did his translocation, and he did a rising card, like a visual right card rising to the top of the deck with one hand. And I was like, there's no way I'm getting in. I was like, there's no way I'm getting in. Just smoked me. But then I happened to realize he's legit one of the best people like on the planet in like close-up magic. So but yeah, it was great. It was great. And then in there, it was like that's when I, I would visit the castle, like, you're on that high, you got into like this exclusive club, and I would go there like 4 to 5 times a week. And that's when like the immersion really started,
Yeah.
and just like you're seeing shows nonstop and you're seeing magicians from all over the world, and you're, taking advantage of the library there. And that's when I went down the rabbit hole pretty deep.
Oh, that's great. What a great place to go down the rabbit hole.
Yeah,
That is
right.
a rabbit hole, boy.
Yeah.
What a beautiful, fortunate thing that
Yeah, it
you
was wild.
Do you still get to the castle fairly
I
often?
do. I was there a couple weeks ago. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, not as much as I did, as I used to, but yeah, I still pop in occasionally.
What benefit was your acting training to being a magician, and what benefit was your training as a magician helping you as an actor?
Well, I think first I'll go the opposite way, actually. So
Okay.
my benefit of being a magician and into being an actor is kind of, knowing how to manipulate a room, knowing how to take charge of a room, knowing how to control a room and control interest. So that's especially good when, if I have to do a monologue or something like that, and it's just knowing how to manage a spectator. That's really where magic came in. And as far as acting and going into how does that help magic, my style of magic is, you've seen Predicto. I'm very much a storyteller. So I love to elicit emotional response. I love like nostalgia and magic. I love like growing up watching the old David Copperfield specials and stuff like that. He always kind of had this story. He did the one of my favorite ones. He talked about, his favorite kind of, he was doing this effect and he said, I do these shows and my favorite kind of magic is what happens when the theater's empty. And he went into this beautiful routine with his dancer and this, massive illusionary effect. But I was like, wow. I was like, if every effect can start out with that little bit of nostalgia, it makes people automatically almost kind of put their guard down and forget they're watching, a magician. And then it's just more about memory. And then you're kind of pulling on heartstrings. And that's the kind of stuff I really love. I love setting this mood and bringing people back to a certain time in their life or to a certain memory or making them remember something they forgot about. Because I love that emotional response in magic. And I'm not saying like I don't want to have people like weeping when they do it, but I think it adds a layer of depth to an effect when you can, have an emotional layer.
Have you ever had a structured act where you were being paid to go? Like in high school, you said you did tricks. Are you that kind of magician, or are you a, hey, Jonathan, do you got anything to show us today kind of magician?
It's funny. Like I've had a structured act for a long time, and I've only done it in, I'll do it like at the museum theater at the castle and stuff like that. I've done it a few times, but never in like a paid atmosphere. I was just kind of like workshopping it, and for me, it was like never as a perf I'm like it was never ready. It was never ready, and people were like, "It's ready. Just do it," But for the most part, I do one strolling gig a year. I do this one charity event every year. That's my thing. But yeah, magic. I've never been the show kind of magician. It's
Yeah.
just, it's like you said. It's a part of my life, but it's not my whole life.
Right. What are what's your go-to in strolling? What do you got on you?
Yeah, one of my favorite effects for strolling is Richard Sanders' Ace. Love, love, love. Knocks it out of the park. I mean, it's kind of the same effect too. There's another one called NFW. It's No Effing Way. Very similar gimmick. I love the coin squeeze, to be quite frank. It's a super old school trick. But again, I talk about how when I was a kid, my grandfather was the handyman in the neighborhood and he always had all these spare parts around. And I would, he'd always make puzzles for me. And one of the puzzles that we made together was this effect. And I do the coin squeeze with like, the little like plumber's rings and stuff. I actually do brainwave, Max Maven's brainwave. And it's, the way I do it, though, I talk about Christmas and I say, when I was a kid, all I wanted for Christmas was a blue bicycle and it was amazing. And I was going to call it the amazing blue bicycle. And I got up one morning and I went under the tree and there was a one present there. And I was disappointed because it did not look like a bicycle. And when I take the wrapping paper off, it's a box of blue bicycle cards. And I go, but Santa didn't get me one blue bicycle. He got me four amazing blue bicycles. And I go into the routine that way. But again, it's like I love that storytelling, adding an emotional layer to it.
I like that a lot. I
Yeah.
think that disarms an audience and we stop thinking about the puzzle and start thinking
Yeah.
about the story in it. I think
Yeah.
that's smart stuff.
And there's a couple transpositions that I kind of created that, they're not marketed, but I do those. And the first thing I say before I perform for anybody, I always take a deep breath and look at them and I say, before we begin, I want to make it very clear, I am not trying to fool you.
Yeah.
Nobody likes being fooled. Nobody made likes being looking like a fool. I go, I'm here to make you experience the things that got me to fall in love with magic, which was that moment when the impossible suddenly became possible. Those little magical moments, that's what we're here trying to find. And that like that really disarms people as well. It's like because then people are like, oh, I'm looking, they're not like watching like a hawk, just like let's experience this together. Hopefully I can make you smile. Hopefully I can have you take something back from our little time together tonight.
That's great. You
Very
know,
nice.
we had Jade on last season. We were talking about doing strolling magic at events, and we were talking to her about, you know, how do you interrupt a group and do that, and how do you psych yourself up. And Jim, I don't know if you remember what she said, but her approach was, you know, you're in a big ballroom, there's all these groups of people, and they're talking to each other and they're having a good time. She said, I would pretend that I was at a high school reunion. And I recognized everybody, didn't remember all their names, but I knew them and they're already friends. And then I would go out and start going from group to group. And she said it just changed everything because I wasn't interrupting. I was coming and talking to people that I already knew. What is your approach, Jonathan?
I usually, like, if it's like a big gathering, I usually run in the room with a mask on and I say, everybody down. And then I take the mask off and I'm going, I'm kidding. I'm a magician. No.
Nice.
Oh, wow. I hope anybody listening don't steal that because that's his trademark thing.
That's right. You can't.
Oh, it's amazing. No, for me, it's like, you know, I don't like doing anything that's too hokey. I mean, most of the time, like, you know, the event that I do every year, the strolling thing, they know there's a magician there. And I just kind of walk up and I say, hey guys, my name is Jonathan. I am part of the entertainment tonight. How we doing? If you don't mind, I'd like to, you know, show you a few things. And that's literally it. It's super simple. It's a weird analogy, but my producing partner and my manager, he always says, you know, an audition is, it's like a first date. And your goal shouldn't be anything but to get a second date. So, and I kind of view magic the same way. It's like, I walk up and I'm going to show you something, and this is going to be like, that's like your first date. And if you like it, I'll show you something else and it'll be our second date, you know? And it's kind of like, I think strolling magic is knowing how to read a room. Sometimes people don't want to be interrupted. You know, when you have the audience on the hook, you know, when they're done. And it's just knowing, it's like Kenny Rogers, you know, you got to know when to fold them, you know? Yeah. And you can be the greatest magician in the world. And sometimes people just aren't into it, you know? Mm-hmm. They want to drink their whiskey and shoot the shit with their friends. So, you know, you walk up there, you do your thing and know when to walk away.
That in itself is an art form.
Yeah, it's true. Mm-hmm.
You come by that knowledge only by doing it and doing it and doing it. Can you sense?
Yeah.
And there are plenty of magicians that have come up to me in situations like that who have not acquired that skill yet.
Yeah.
When it's time to go.
Yeah. And I think it's a lot about knowing the scope of the event you're performing in. You know, I've competed in like the strolling showdown at the Magic Castle a few times. And like everyone there knows what they're there for, right? Like the charity event I do every year, everybody knows there's two magicians walking around. But sometimes you know, there's parties and you don't know there's a, like somebody hired a magician and they come up and the magician will make it about them. And they're like, I'm the entertainment. And it's like, you are this isn't the party about you. You're here to enhance the party, you know? Yeah. Like, and I think who said this recently? I forget who said, I think it was Bryan Cranston, but he said, everybody has a role, you know, and you have to know your role, whether you're on a movie set, if you're a background actor or if you're the lead, or if you have two lines in one scene, know your role. Everybody has a job,
yep.
You know, and no job is necessarily more important than the other, but it's just knowing your role, doing your job to the best of your ability in that moment, you know? And that's that. I think that's a lot about performing. You know, you never want to be, it's like one of my buddies is a stand-up comic and he talks about, can you imagine if like, he talks about strip clubs and it's like, you know, people walk up, like this dancers walk up to you like, hey, do you want to dance? And it's like, you know, at the Magic Castle, it's like the same thing. It's like a strip club of magicians. People like walk up to you, they're like, hey, want to see a trick? You know, it's like, know your role, you know your role. Know when people are interested, know when they're not.
Yes. And your role changes from room to room. And
absolutely.
The smart person absolutely recognizes when they're the lead and when they just need to step back and let the lead.
Yeah. There's a big difference between you being a strolling magician who's hired to do an event or you being, you know, performing in the close-up gallery where people are coming to see you, mm-hmm. You know, it's a very big difference in entertainment there.
Agreed.
So is Predicto the first released marketed trick you've done?
It is. I've had many other effects that, like I said, that I've created, but this one, yeah, this one is, it really has a special place in my heart. I don't know. I kind of talked to Brent about it, and I pitched it, and he's like, we're for sure marketing this. And I was like, you think so? And he's like, absolutely, we're marketing this. Yeah, it did really well. And we, you know, we did the horror version because I loved horror movies. I don't know if you saw that. And we have a few other, additions we're thinking about releasing as well.
Are you a superhero fan, or is that just part of the story?
I am. I mean, no, growing up, Spider-Man and Superman were like, I flipped out with Superman movies. Absolutely flipped out. Yeah.
So where did Predicto come from? How did you create that?
Well, I was at the Magic Apple, and I saw someone performing this, or this guy was in there, and he was purchasing this effect that he swore by, and it was called Misprediction, where basically you have four spectators select cards, four separate cards, and one by one you find them, and then the fourth card, it's the final spectator, and it's a miss. You don't get it, and you have these four cards sitting on the table, but when you turn them all over, the backs of the cards are the card that was the fourth spectator's card. Nice. And I said, I like this. I like it a lot. I go, but for me, the minute you use cards, that lets the spectator go, these are gimmicked. Like if you can turn all these cards over, that means they're not a real deck to begin with, you know? And there was kind of a misconnect there if people thought about it. And I thought about, you know, it's super. I was like, what do people love? And what's an easier way to do this? And I said, well, if you just had like this idea of a kid that loves superheroes, and his alter ego was this guy Predicto, and he can always predict the future. Well, now you're in that world, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, and it's a kid would do it. So he wouldn't use playing cards. It was like, he would use his crayons, and he would make his own little cards for this thing. And that's kind of where the whole impetus for the effect came from. And it was as simple as that. And like I said, the whole story revolved around that one hook. Was I came up in a, I don't know, sometimes these lines just come to me, but in the prediction envelope, I said, in this envelope, there's one prediction and one prediction only. And if you give Predicto enough chances, Predicto will never be wrong. And there, it's kind of a funny play on words, because it's four predictions, but at the end, it is only one prediction, you know?
That's right. It's very a charming, true. Charming trick. Can you just talk about the process a little bit from, okay, I got an idea, and now how am I going to turn this into something that could be marketed?
Absolutely. So I have my degree is in playwriting. I have a BFA in theater. My focus was in playwriting and directing. So I love a good story. But when it came to the actual production of the effect, I totally followed Brent's lead. He has released so many effects, and this was a whole new world to me. So Brent was like, I need you. He's like, you get this thing to where you think it's ready to go, and I will get it made. So I literally came home. I wrote this entire story about my nephew and about how he loves superheroes, and now, or how I grew up loving superheroes, and now I got my nephew who loves superheroes, and how we created this character Predicto together. And I was like, now how do I make this fully realized? And I was like, again, I didn't want to use playing cards. And I was like, oh my gosh, this would be great. I was like, I just saw these question marks, like almost like the Riddler. So I started playing with design options with these question marks. And I was like, let's make it more real. And I was like, it wouldn't be just like a typewriter boldface or font on these cards. I go, he would draw them. He would have crayons or markers, and he would draw them. So I started looking in all these fonts, and I designed this font that kind of looked like a child's, you know, handwriting the way a child would write. And it's funny because like letters are backwards, and I mixed up capital letters with lowercase letters and kind of created this. It looks like a kid drew these, you know? And now the trick was really starting to be realized. And then this is pretty funny, but I'm going to give you a big secret of Predicto here. We used AI to generate the prediction photos. And I literally, I went into an AI program, and I said, draw a children's crayon drawing of Wonder Woman, and then, or generate a child's crayon drawing of Spider-Man. And we kept on modifying these, but they're an AI generated stuff on the back. So it looks like a kid drew them. And that's how we had the production stuff. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. And it was crazy, because you'd be surprised how many versions we scrapped. It was like, we like this one. We like this in this photo. And we like this in this photo. We had to try and merge them together. That was legit one of the hardest things, like trying to find the right damn photo that we're going to, because it's ultimately has to be the kicker ending. It's like, it has to, you know, so actually getting that down perfect, that took us, you know, a couple of weeks to really iron that out.
Well, it's a great effect. I really enjoyed watching you perform it. What's kind of been the reaction to it when you do it, or straight across the board now that it's a marketed effect?
I am completely blown away by the response. We sold out pretty quick of the one we so we had a limited run. We didn't package all of them. We sold out of the ones we packaged. We repackaged the next. Murphy's bought a ton. They sold out. They ordered more. And it's just been overwhelming. It's like, I don't necessarily think you like these effects have to be like knuckle busting effects and you have to learn all these slides. I think sometimes the simplest stuff with a good story, like self-working card tricks are legit miracles sometimes, So part of the whole process, Brent and I, again, we had five different methods that we're going to use. And we're like, what's the simplest one that a kid can do? It's like no slights, no elastic, no rough smooth, just like out of the box, ready to perform.
As a non-magician, I can tell you the instructions were great. I'm going with the much simpler force that you do at the end, rather than I'm not going to try mixing cards while I'm talking in front of people. The only variation that I've made on it at the end, I don't, you lay them out so you can just flip it over and it's there. And for me, that felt too perfect. Like, so I just flip it over so that now there's four weird things. You go, what is that? And then you just move them into place and it's
Love
Spider-Man,
it.
which I for me worked better because it's like, oh yeah, it seems more
I love
accidental.
it. Brent, that's how Brent does it. So I am insanely OCD. Like insanely. Like if there's like a crooked, like you can see my photos on the wall. They're like, if like, so for me, I did that. And I think also the way I demonstrated that in the instructional, I think it's the easiest way to make sure they line up. 'Cause I don't, I if I'll tell you a funny story. To me, that made the most sense on how to explain it, right? Instead of saying, oh, then turn them over and then fish it to try to figure out how to put them together. There was a gentleman, and this is why I love Brent. There was a gentleman who purchased Predicto, came back and returned it because he said it was too difficult. And said, quit magic. But it plays like, it people love it. People, and I am all for like make it your own, man. I present an idea. I think, any effect that you learn, it make it your own, personalize it, change the pattern, however it's gonna make your performance of the effect, go for it. Have at it, man.
Any other reactions you're getting from buyers besides it's too difficult?
No, there were a couple of people that were like, oh, you stole this from me, or I had this. I forget who it was, but there was someone that tried to say like I owed him credit because he had this thing published in like the 1980s in some obscure magazine. And dude, I was like, I don't know your effect. I don't know. And it wasn't even remotely close to the same idea. But I think all these people are like trying to grasp. It's like when people create an effect, they're like, oh, you need to give me, this is my idea. Which I did. I mean, the effect that inspired me to do it, I gave credit for right there, that misprediction effect. I have no problem saying it. I didn't just come up with this out of the blue. Something triggered this in me. But the response has been overwhelming. I do it actually at conventions around town. I've done it. I went with Brent to a few. The horror one. So I was an actor. I've been in horror movies and I do appearances at horror conventions. So I started doing it at horror conventions and selling them at horror conventions and stuff, and people love it.
Any tips for anybody that might be listening, thinking I have something that I've always wanted to market? Any tips that you would give them?
Do it. That's my tip. Ready? My buddy Ross, my best friend in the world, is a huge songwriter, massive songwriter. And he has the studio. And in his studio, he has this big neon sign that says, geniuses finish things. And everybody can have an idea. Finish it. Do it. I don't care if you have to make it by hand. Find a way to get it done. Finish it and get it out there. And you know what? It might suck, but you finished it and you got it out there. And I guarantee you've learned something from that. And your next one's going to be better. But do it. Get it out there. As a producer, my producing. I did this film, 8-Bit Christmas for New Line Cinema a couple years ago. And it was like my baby. I'd worked on this thing for like 5 years. Me and my partner had got the rights. I found this book. We got the rights. We made it. We turned it into this massive movie. And I was, during the whole development process, I was super precious about the entire movie. I was like, this can't happen. This has to happen. This has to happen. And my buddy He said, "Sadowski, you can't be precious." He's like, "Number one rule, get the movie made." He goes, "Otherwise you're just a producer who's never produced anything." You know? And it's true. It's, you know, get it done. That's my best advice. If you have an idea, figure out a way to do it and do it.
That is the best advice.
Amen.
Yeah.
We're going to cross the streams here. And Jonathan,
Do
I'm
it.
just going to warn you. Last year, we had Nicholas Meyer on, who did Star Trek Wrath of Khan, and he did Time After Time. And he'd written a bunch of Sherlock Holmes books. And he came on saying, "Oh, come on, but I just want to talk about Sherlock Holmes. I'd rather not go into the other things because I talk about the other things all the time." And it was a great episode, two-part episode. Nicholas Meyer is a great storyteller. His Sherlock Holmes stuff is amazing. But at one point, he made a reference to Wrath of Khan. And Mr. Cunningham, my friend here, said, "Sir, you've opened the door. I'm coming in," because Jim is a huge William Shatner fan. And
Ah,
so we
nice.
just have to ask about.
About my boy Bill. He's on the wall right there behind
There he
me.
is.
Oh, wow. On this show, we'll call it Bleep, My Dad Says.
My dad says, yes, I've heard of it. Yeah,
Yes.
you
How did
have.
that happen for you? What?
So that entire process was so I auditioned for that role and they wound up casting some. I'm trying to remember exactly how it happened now. I know they wound up casting someone else who was a friend of mine. His name was Ryan Devlin. They cast Ryan. And then I was going to do this other show called Wilfred. I screen tested for this show called Friends with Benefits. I didn't get that. And then they wanted me to do the show Wilfred that Elijah Wood wound up doing. And as I was screen testing for Wilfred, they decided they were going to recast the main character in Bleep My Dad Says. So they brought me back in to Bleep My Dad Says. I said no to Wilfred. I screen tested for Bleep My Dad Says and I got hired. And I wish I could say it was the greatest experience of my life. It was not. William Shatner is absolutely lovely. The cast was absolutely lovely, but there were some personalities who on that set who I dream about running into again.
With a car?
Had that not been my first show, there would have been some fireworks on that set. I was yeah. It was one of the worst experiences of my acting career. And I'm okay to say that now.
Well, I'm sorry to have brought it up.
No, it's fine. I'm happy to talk about it. And yeah, there was like I said, nothing but praise for the cast and crew. But there were some people there that the Jonathan Sadowski today that they would have gotten it. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to dwell too deeply
No, that's
here,
fine.
but give me one Shatner story that you like.
I will tell you one of my I don't think I've ever told this story before. Wow.
Oh, fabulous.
So we it was like our first week of rehearsals. Now, mind you, they shot this entire pilot already. And we have to reshoot all of my stuff and reshoot the whole thing again in front of a whole new live audience. And there was this joke that Bill didn't quite understand. And him and the writers were very, what's the word I was trying to say? They were very sweet with Bill. And they were like, you know, it's this, this, and this. And he was like, I just don't, I don't get, I don't, I'm not, you know. And I said, Bill, it's like this. And he goes, Jonathan, not now. And he like,
Oh,
all right,
man.
fair. I've known you 3 days, right?
Yes.
And I kind of walked away and I let them do their thing. And I remember I was eating lunch and Bill walked up to me and I feel a pat on my shoulder. And I look up and it's William Shatner. And he kind of leans down, and he puts his face right next to mine. He says, "Sorry about that, but you didn't have a dog in that fight."
Oh.
I said, "You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right." And ever like him and I, we had breakfast together every morning. I went to his house for the Super Bowl. We were thick as thieves. He was wonderful and a total pro, like total pro.
Well, I'm a big, big, huge honking fan and have been since the early days of Star Trek. For me, I didn't see it till it was in syndication, but I'm in fact, I work for our local NHL franchise here, and Mr. Shatner was in town for one of the conventions, and they sent me with a jersey, our Wild jersey,
Yep.
with his name on the back, and I was to try to get to him and ask him to say, you know, hey, we were going into the playoffs. Can we, you know, would you just say, hey, Minnesota Wild, go get him? And so I was the producer of the thing, took me there, and then he said, you wait here. I'm gonna go talk to him. And so he went. They were maybe 50 feet from me, and I saw them talking. And Bill kind of, Mr. Shatner kind of looked over at me, and I held up the jersey, and I saw him turn back to the other guy and kind of shake his head like that, and then he walked away. And the producer came back and said, he'd love to help you out, and he appreciates the jersey. And I said, he can have it one way or the other. He said he doesn't want it. He's a big Montreal Canadiens fan, and he's afraid if he supports the Minnesota Wild, he's going to get some blowback in Montreal because of it. And so I totally respect that. But
But you still have a jersey that says Shatner on the back?
in my closet, and I occasionally put it on.
Oh my God, is that hilarious?
Yeah, and but that's as close as I've ever got to getting a chance to meet him.
Oh,
And
he's wonderful. Yeah,
someday I
he's
will.
great.
Yeah.
I actually ran into him recently, or not recently. This has to be a couple, 2, 3 years ago now. We were at this restaurant in LA, and my buddy, I was there. We were there with a friend, and my buddy's like, "Shatner's over there." I was like, "Oh, no way!" So I get up and I walk over to him. He's getting up there. He's like 90, you know, and I kind of kneel down at his table and said, "Bill," and he looks at me and he's like, and he kind of like he was like taken aback, and I said, "It's Jonathan from My Dad Says," and he goes, "You've aged." It was funny.
I really thought when you knelt down at the table and said, hi, Bill, he was going to say, Jonathan, not now.
That
I
would have
thought
been
that's
amazing.
where we were going.
That would have been great.
All right, let's wrap up here with one final magic question.
Sure.
What excites you about magic today?
That's a really good question. I think what excites me about magic today is what excites me about all forms of art and how, when you watched a movie, like when we watched Superman, the original Superman, you thought that was the pinnacle of technology. And now here we are with movies like Avatar. And I remember when I first saw like the Zigzag Lady, I was like, that's the pinnacle of magic. And for an art form that focuses on making the impossible possible, I look forward to seeing what is possible in the future with magic. I think the artistry and the tech, these sleight of hand technicians that are out there, they're doing stuff that we never would have dreamed of, 20 years ago. And, now with technology and all this stuff, like, you have these companies out there working with technology and magic. There's miracles that are being created. And I look forward to unpacking some of those miracles in the future because that's the, like I said at the beginning, what I love about magic is falling in love with those moments where the impossible becomes possible. And I am excited to see what these creators are going to show you is possible to do.
Making the impossible possible and falling in love with that. I love his attitude about magic, his excitement about what's coming in the future.
And I love everything about Shatner. So it was a really great interview for many reasons, that not the least of them for me.
This is just another example of someone who we've talked to who had magic as a background and kind of can fall back on it when he needs to. But he certainly has benefited in magic from his background in acting, where he knows how to control a room, he knows how to do an audition. If you can imagine being at the Magic Castle
Jeez.
and auditioning for that.
No, I can't. I wouldn't even consider it. So, kudos to him. And also, there are many things about this interview I like, but I always like it when somebody is humble enough to say, I came out of the room, looked at the next guy, and went, oh crap, I'm never going to get it. I love that. That says volumes about a human being to me, that you can realize where you are on the magic spectrum, or any spectrum for that matter.
Yeah. And, Shatner. You got a
Yeah,
couple
then there's
Shatner
Shatner.
stories.
I can't get enough of the Shatner stories. I know how old he is, and I know that as I think all of the great English actors have said, I realize there's less in front of me than there is in the rearview mirror. I've got to find a way. I've got to find a time that I can actually meet the man and tell him what a huge influence he had on me as a young actor.
Well, Jim, this took a lot of planning, but turn around.
Is he beaming into my kitchen?
He's not. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Please, if there's anyone I know who could sort of make that happen for me, yeah, you would be right at the top of the damn list. So I don't ask for much. I don't. I really don't.
I know you don't. Anyway, if you get a chance, pick up Predicto or at least look at the link in the show notes. It's a delight. I'm a non-magician. I did the simpler version of it. There's a slightly more complicated way of forcing a card, and I did the easiest way of doing it. But the kids loved it. It was a big hit, and it's a card trick that doesn't involve playing cards. It's a card trick that involves superheroes. So I loved it.
In their wheelhouse, I'm a big superhero fan through my son. I wasn't as a kid, but I am now.
Well, you should get it.
I should get it. I should get everything. That's the problem.
There's
the amount of magic I own versus the amount of magic I do would lead one to believe that I'm an idiot because I have a lot of magic and I do very little. So if the occasion presents itself and there is I'm at a convention, let's say, I don't know, somewhere in the Midwest, and there is a copy of it for sale, I will absolutely buy it.
All right, you hear that, dealers? Reach out to Jim Cunningham.
Yeah.
Because he's an easy, easy mark. Anyway, again to Jonathan for talking with us. I love chatting with him. And speaking of things we love, we're going to do, because we're smart, we're remembering to do this.
Yeah.
We're going to do the I Love That segment. So do you have an I Love That this time
I do,
around?
Yeah, I do have an I Love That. I assume people could get this. I mean, it's widely... Sirius is a thing that people can tap into if they want, Sirius Radio. I really have been enjoying a podcast called Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend.
Well, I'm gonna stop you right there and tell you that you can get that anywhere you get podcasts.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, it does, not just on Sirius. Any podcast provider have it, because I don't really have Sirius, but I've listened to Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend, and I will be honest, I only listen to the interview episodes, not the ones where he talks to fans, but he has some great interview folks on there.
Absolutely, he does. And he's, you know what? He's a good interviewer.
Yeah, he is.
Over and above being Conan O'Brien and funny and quirky and all of the things that we've come to know and expect from him, he can really ask good questions, and he's willing to listen, which not every interviewer is. So I enjoy that immensely. I just wrapped up the Carol Burnett episode.
They went to her for that one, which is rare for them.
Why wouldn't you? If Carol Burnett said, we'd go to Carol Burnett if she was... Just find out if Carol Burnett has a magic background. It's really quite charming, I think.
Yeah, and you can cherry pick through the interviewees you want.
Right.
Well, that's an excellent one. That's an excellent one. I believe that my guy might have been on Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend at some point. He certainly has been on a lot of the different podcasts promoting himself. There's a comedian named Gary Goldman. And I have a link to probably his most famous routine. He went on Conan and did this, I think, 6 or 8 minute routine about a documentary film about the people who abbreviated the state's names. And it's about the funniest routine I've ever. It is so honed and so perfect, and he delivers it so well. And that's sort of my entry point to Gary Goldman.
I think it was everybody's entry point to Gary Goldman, even though, you know, you see him and you realize, well, you didn't start with that. So
no, he's been around for
30 years or whatever. I'm just getting to it now. But yeah, it's brilliant and so sharp and witty and absolutely smart from the get-go that you can't help but love him.
Thanks very much. I just wanted to recommend a documentary to everyone, and then I'm going to go. it's about the men and one woman who abbreviated all 50 states down to 2 letters. All you have to know for this is that we have 50 states in America, and they each have a 2-capital-letter abbreviation. But that wasn't always the case. Up until, I want to say, 1973, and so I will. Up until 1973, every state had its own length of abbreviation, and it was chaos. Like Massachusetts was MASS period, Florida was FLA, Utah was Utah. They just dropped the H, not much of an abbreviation. But then the post office said, no, every state has to have a two capital letter abbreviation. And so they convened a crack squad of abbreviators. They assembled a ragtag outfit of rogues, misfits, and ne'er-do-wells. How often do well? Ne'er. They ne'er did well. And they were charged with abbreviating all 50 states down to two letters. Now, I read this description to the documentary, and much like you, thought to myself, how are they going to make a 98-minute documentary about a task that couldn't have taken more than 6 minutes to complete? Boy, was I wrong. It was an adventure. Ups and downs, ins and outs, friends became enemies, enemies became friends. They started off, they thought it was going to be easy because Alabama lulled them into a false sense of security. They said, Alabama, AL, holy crap, this is easy.
That's just a sample of it. I have a link in the show notes to the full routine. I also have a link to, he has several great stand-up specials, but he has one which is sort of half stand-up special, half documentary, called The Great Depression, which is about when he was having his most serious bout with depression and went home at age 40-something, maybe, late 30s, early 40s, and returned to his childhood bedroom to work his way through it, which he mentions, he sort of semi-chronicles it in his book Misfit, which I'll also have a link to, which Misfit is mostly about his school years from kindergarten, I think, into college, but he intersperses that with, he was writing it while he was having this major depression. Mm. And it sounds like a downer. It's not. He's very, very, very funny and very insightful. So anyway, that's Gary Gulman is the I Love It that I have this time. And you can listen to the abbreviation of states' names in the show notes or go and see one of his stand-up specials or read his book at the library if you want. I bet there's a great audiobook of it as well. And if he comes to your town, and you're looking for stand-up comedy, you know, I would say he's in the top five working today.
I agree.
When it comes to originality and skill as a stand-up comic.
And just in case people think that we have somehow talked beforehand on what our particular I Love This is going to be, because both of them, we got to Gary Gulman, I think, through Conan O'Brien, and my whole deal was Conan O'Brien. We did not talk about this. We just happen to be on the same damn wavelength most of the time.
Yeah. And then when we aren't, it's really funny because it's like we're speaking to two people that are speaking to two different languages.
Exactly.
It's very puzzling. All right. So those are the I Love It. There's links in the show notes. We got to get down to business here. This is, we had a long interview, and then we did Casablanca, and now we're doing this. So let's just jump in. Last time, I think you read
chapter 12.
Yeah, okay. So, well, this is episode 413. So this would be up. This would be chapter 13. Let me recap quickly what happened.
Would you? I'd appreciate 12. That. This is a recap of chapter 12.
Yep. Okay. Eli left the comic book store. Got a call from Tracy, picked up from the hospital. This is where we discussed the idea of don't go to slippery places. Eli asked Harry a difficult question. Do you like my act? And then he spent the evening practicing his act because he just doesn't practice enough. He has gotten a little lazy, and he admits that. That was the end of chapter 12, taking us right now into chapter 13.
Chapter 13. Mr. Marks, welcome to Bimax. Have you been offered a beverage? Sherry Lisbon asked the question in such a manner that it came out more like a potential accusation against her assistant than a warm, hospitable offer directed toward me. I'll say this for her. She knew how to establish an immediate tone for a meeting. As a corporate magician, I've met my share of CEOs, and you can set your comic bungling stereotypes aside. The ones I've met have been dynamic, magnetic, and surprisingly sharp. Their focus may be on the bottom line, but most have known how to carry a conversation and how to win over a room. Some have even been remarkably warm and funny. This last was not the case with Sherry Lisbon, the CEO of Bimax. The snowy and icy view through her large office windows was warmer than the hand which shook mine. Her steel blue eyes were colder than the skating rink visible through the window on what must have been
a corporate-built man-made pond. Her well-coiffed hair was so blonde it might have been white, but that could have been a trick of the light. She wore a tailored skirt and coat combination, which was accessorized with a variety of bracelets and rings emblazoned with stones of various colors. Around her neck was a simple gold necklace, which she touched unconsciously after shaking my hand, perhaps reassuring herself I hadn't lifted it in some well-practiced pickpocket move. Of the four possible suspects I had met, Sherry Lisbon was the biggest puzzle, and that was clearly by design. Clifford Thomas was a flat-out local celebrity, and Randall Glendower was an internet sensation. So research on those two, if I had needed it, which I hadn't, would be deep and plentiful. Chip Kavanaugh's presence on the internet was less pervasive. The Kavanaugh Bank empire was publicly owned, albeit a huge percentage of the company was still owned by the family. And so finding out about him had been a relative ease. In fact, I'd been able to accomplish it with my phone while parked in a visitor spot outside his downtown condo. Sherry Lisbon was something else altogether. BuyMax was a privately held company, and a little digging on my part demonstrated just how private it was. The company website was designed to sell products of all shapes and sizes and make that process easy. It also seemed designed to tell you as little about the company and its owner as possible. Mission accomplished, I had decided that morning, after spending two fruitless hours trying to get a sense of my next and final interview subject. "The police warned me of your visit," she said with a smile but no humor, gesturing to a seat in front of her desk as she returned to the rich leather chair behind it. There was nothing on the desk's surface, not even a piece of paper, a pen, or a phone. Given how barren it was, I wondered for a moment why it needed to be so large. I lowered myself into one of the two chairs facing the desk. "Yes, thank you for seeing me on such short notice," I began, settling into the chair uncomfortably. "They gave me the impression the visit was mandatory. However, I can't imagine how such a request could be effectively enforced." Her words were clipped, and she sounded angry, but her face revealed no emotion. In her late 40s, she had high, strong cheekbones and a long, thin neck. If surgery had been involved to create her look, it was an impressive and invisible job. "It can't be," I said with my most sincere smile, "which is why I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me." "Mr. Marks, I can tell you what I told them," she said, getting right down to it. "I certainly knew Tyler James and had done some business with him in the past. Their arrival to question me was the first I had heard of his death." "That must have come as quite a shock," I suggested. She stared at me as if I had just begun speaking a foreign language, so I blabbered on. "I mean, finding out about his death that way." "We weren't close in any sense of the word," she said, throwing a glance at her assistant, which spoke volumes. The young lady hightailed it out of the room so quickly that had this been a cartoon, she would have stirred up a small dust cloud in her wake. "I reacted as I would to the loss of any vendor." "And how is that?" She looked at me with the closest thing to an emotion she had revealed thus far, if slight puzzlement qualifies as an emotion. "How is what?" "Well, how do you typically react to the loss of a vendor?" "You get a new vendor," she said. It wasn't as if I was being scolded, but it felt darn close. Having not been scolded in, 25 years, it took me a moment to recognize the feeling. I didn't like it any more now than I had when I was a kid. She continued to stare at me. Somewhere, I heard a clock ticking, even though none was visible in the room. "What sort of business did you conduct with Mr. James?" I ventured. "Buying or selling?" "Exclusively buying," she said as she spotted a piece of invisible dust on the desk and removed it with great care and unnecessary precision, being it was invisible and all. "What sorts of things did you buy?" I continued, feeling like I was coming toward the end of a painful and rather futile game of 20 questions. "I honestly don't remember," she said. I buy lots of things. That is, in fact, my business. She made the slightest nod to TV monitors on the far wall, which silently projected the live images from studios around the country or around the world. There were a lot of monitors, and on each one of them, in a different BIMAX studio, a plethora of products were being presented for sale. All the screens were silent, but the scrolling text on each screen represented a diverse variety of languages, many of which I recognized, but none of which I could read. I turned back to her. I thought you were in the business of selling. She shook her head, oh, so slightly, and I thought I recognized the slimmest trace of a smile cross her lips. I'm in the business of selling in order to provide me with the resources to be in the business of buying. Sometimes I sell the things I buy, often at a significant profit. Sometimes I simply keep what I have purchased. The change in subject seemed to suddenly energize her. Tell me, Mr. Marks, do you shop? I'm sorry? Do you, from time to time, visit a department store, or perhaps our own Mall of America, and move from store to store with no other intention than to discover something to buy? Or peruse the internet with no other goal than to find a treasure you never knew existed, but now must own at all costs? I was about to attempt to form an answer, but she cut me off. No, you don't strike me as the type. She gave me another long look, which felt sort of piercing. No, not the type at all. What type do you think I am? I asked, trying to sound confident in the boldness of my question. I doubt it fooled her for a second. You, like so many people, mostly men, but not confined to one gender, are targeted buyers. You need something, you find it, you buy it, and then you're on to something else. But that's not how you do it? No, that's not my approach. For me, there is nothing more fulfilling than finding an object, a rarity, a one-of-a-kind item, and swooping in and plucking it away. She hit the word plucking with such force, I felt myself jump, just a little. Does it matter what it is? She shrugged. Sometimes. Not always. For you, it's the swooping and the plucking. This produced, for the first time, an actual smile. I suppose you could put it that way. Is that what you did with Tyler James? Swooped and plucked? Saying it out loud made it sound vaguely dirty, but if she was offended, she kept it to herself. She turned toward me. It felt like she was either starting to warm up to the subject or to me. I desperately hoped it was the subject. Tyler and I used to play a little game, she said. She stared me down, like she was teasing me to ask more. A game? I worked hard and succeeded in keeping my voice from cracking. What kind of game? Sometimes he would find himself in a situation with two bidders, each going after the same object, tooth and nail, each one outbidding the other, an escalating battle, as it were. If Tyler was feeling like a bad boy, and he was often a bad boy, don't think for a second he wasn't, he might get in touch and allow me to enter the fray. To swoop, I suggested. Yes, to swoop in at the last second and outbid them all. And pluck. Yes. Again, almost a smile, but not quite. Swoop and pluck. She basked in the recollection for a long moment. Why? I asked, breaking the silence. Was it something you wanted? Was what something I wanted? The thing you outbid them on. I have no idea. In fact, I often had no idea what I was bidding on. Now it was my turn to feel like someone was speaking a foreign language. Then why do it? I really can't explain, she said, her voice dropping to just above a whisper. But Mr. Marks, let me share this with you. There are few pleasures on this earth equal to stepping in at the last second and taking something someone else desires. I mean, something they really, really want. An object, a relationship, a person. She turned and looked at me. Her eyes were cold, yet they somehow burned into me. You should try it sometime. You might be surprised just how pleasurable that can be. Mercifully, our interview concluded moments later, and I was quickly and efficiently escorted back out the way I had arrived, through a maze of cubes and TV monitors and white noise. Dusk had come, and the thermometer in my car put the temperature at a frigid 14 degrees, but it felt balmy compared to the arctic chill I'd felt in Sherry Lisman's office. I had turned back as I exited, and I caught her eye. The look she gave me was decidedly predatory, but, and I might have been imagining this, and I hope I was, there was a sexual component which was both undeniable and frightening. I tried to convince myself I was imagining it, and I think I almost succeeded. Once the car started, I immediately switched on the seat warmer and cranked the heater up to full. However, I didn't start to feel any real warmth until I was nearly home.
I feel so sorry for Eli having to have gone through that encounter with Sherry Lisbon. She is an amalgamation of several executives I dealt with in my years doing meetings and events. Jim and I met doing meetings and events and videos. I've often said that the meeting business is the executive ego business. And everybody has an ego, everybody does, but give someone a title, a little bit of power, and they go insane and they can just be horrible. And Sherry Lisbon is an example. I remember, you know Tom Lieberman, right?
I do know Tom Lieberman.
He's a local producer and musician and a super talented guy. We ran in the same circles doing meetings and events. And I remember chatting with him once saying, you know, it's interesting. You spend a lot of time, in, at least I did and he did, in executive suites talking to executives because that's who we dealt with. And for the most part, you know, they're pretty good. They're, you know, you see these examples on TV like Mr. Carlson from WKRP of these idiots. It's like, no, for the most part, these people are pretty smart who got there, or they're sociopaths and pretty smart. But I said, if there was one guy, boy, if I never have to work with him again, he was just the worst. And Tom said, oh, I have one of those too. He's a monster. I hope I never work with him again. And I said, what was his name? And he said the name. I said, it was the same guy. It was the exact same guy who we felt.
And here's my Tom Lieberman story.
Yes.
It involves you, I think, but I don't think you were on the show.
Okay.
So we were going to Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, mm-hmm. to do a show for somebody that makes snowmobiles.
Yep.
And I misread when my plane left. And I had gone up to St. Cloud, which for those of you that are not in Minnesota, it's about an hour and 15 minutes from home here. And we had went up to see a show on a Friday night. And then I was flying to Coeur d'Alene on Saturday. And I thought my plane left at 3. So I thought, well, there's no real rush to get back to. I mean, I got oodles of time. Plane left at 11:15. And it wasn't until I got home and looked that I realized, ooh, I really screwed this up. And I think I called you and said, hey, I know you're not going to be on this show, but it's a show that your company you work for is producing. Mm-hmm. Who is the producer? And you said, it's Tom Lieberman. And I said, he's already out there. And I said, can you let him know that I'm not going to be arriving on the plane? And he said, well, he's coming to pick you up. And I said, stop him. Please let him know I'm not going to be there. And I guess you couldn't get him, and he showed up, and as a gag, because we know each other, he had printed my name on a sign and was standing there with my name on a sign. And I ended up talking the gate agent into allowing me to take a standby flight, even though it was completely my fault. She was kind to a young actor and got me on the next flight. I landed, I think, at midnight. I had to rent a car and drive to Coeur d'Alene. And when I got up the next morning to go to breakfast, there's Lieberman in the breakfast nook holding that sign with my name on it. So funny, you should bring him up. Again, we're on the same damn wavelength, folks.
Yes. I'll have a link to some of Tom's stuff in the show notes. He's enormously tremendous. Creative.
Yeah.
Fellow, and also the nicest guy in the world.
He really is. Yeah.
Very, very nice guy. Speaking of nice people, next time, our next episode, we're going to listen to chapter 14 of The Miser's Dream, but we're also going to revisit a bit of a conversation with a friend of the show, Kayla Drescher. Kayla has been on the show a couple times. The last time she was on, she talked about bar magic, and it's great stories about goofing around with customers doing magic at a bar where the bartender was in on it with her and kept stealing things and giving them to her. And it was a great interview. But next time, we're going to revisit a conversation about pronouns, which is always an interesting topic, and she had some great things to say about it. So we will do that next time. We will listen to chapter 14, and we'll also have a couple new I love that from Jim and me, and we won't know what they are until we say them to each other. So
that's
next time. Take care, everybody.
Bye-bye. Conan O'Brien will not figure in the next show.
Don't be so sure.
Okay. This has been Behind the Page, the Eli Marks podcast, with your hosts, John Gaspard and Jim Cunningham. Produced by Alberts Bridge Books at Grass Lake Studios. Find this podcast and all the books in the Eli Marks series at elimarksmysteries.com. That's ELIMARKS, mysteries.com. And thanks for listening.